to you today for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is a locally made exploration into positive solutions to some of today's ecological challenges for all of us working to create a healthier future for our communities and for the world you live in.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Elaine McMillan. On today's show, Teresa Wilkie will talk with Craig Volland, Agriculture Committee Chair of the Kansas Sierra Club. They'll talk about issues of modern concentrated animal feed operations, including one raised by a recent favorable ruling in Kansas that retracted permits issued to pig feedlot operators by the KDHE. Hope our program has reached you prior to dinner. We hope to get you thinking about what you eat and how it was produced. Stay tuned. But first, the environmental news for the week of January 20th, 2020. Democracy Now! Reports, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, dozens of Harvard Law students disrupted a job recruiting event for a law firm that is representing ExxonMobil in lawsuits over the oil giant's efforts to deceive shareholders and the public about fossil fuels' role in fueling the climate crisis. The 2010s were the hottest decade ever recorded as atmospheric carbon dioxide levels soared to record levels, according to a new report based on data from NASA and NOAA, which found global surface temperatures surged by more than 1 degree Celsius, or about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels. 2019 was the hottest year for the world's oceans on record. That's according to a new study published in the Advances in Atmospheric Sciences Journal. The Earth's surface temperature also recorded its second hottest year on record last year, as the climate crisis leads to the warming of the Earth's oceans and atmosphere. The Trump administration is planning to divert an additional $7 billion from the military budget for the construction of Trump's promised border wall, bringing the total amount allocated to border wall construction to over $18 billion. So far, reports of construction of the wall have also included reports of destruction of native land, plant, and animal life. NPR reports, the Missouri Department of Natural Resources has added 60 lakes and streams to this year's draft list, already at over 300, of lakes and rivers that do not meet water quality standards. Many of the listed water bodies had high concentrations of bacteria or algae linked to runoff from cities, towns, and farms. Nearly one-third of waterways had high concentrations of E. coli bacteria, including sections of the River de Pere and the Missouri River. Other common issues included mercury in fish tissue and high algae concentrations. Kansas Sierra Club reports, the proposed expansion of the Holcomb, Kansas coal-fired power plant has been halted. Kansas-based Sunflower Electric has now announced it is canceling the proposed Holcomb 2 coal plant. EcoWatch reports, a new report by a global activist group reveals that, despite YouTube's pledge to combat misinformation, the popular video site owned by Google has failed to crack down on this problem when it comes to climate change. Videos containing false or misleading information on climate change continue to reach millions of users through YouTube's recommendation algorithm. And now for our show.
Thanks for tuning in to Eco Radio KC. We're lucky tonight. I've got in the studio Craig Volland, Agriculture Committee Chair for the Kansas Sierra Club. Hi, Craig.
Hi, how are you? I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, thank you for coming in. And Dave Bennett Freeling is our engineer, and so we're all going to talk with you, Craig, about starting. When did you join the Sierra Club?
1994.
And why did you join the Sierra Club in 94?
Well, because a very good friend of mine was active and a major leader in the Kansas chapter of the Sierra Club. And when he found out I was moving to Kansas from Missouri, he said, "You've got to do this." And so I said, "Okay." That was a long time ago. That's Craig Wolf. You might have heard of him.
Well, sure. Craig Wolf is famous. And And Craig Wolf's mother, I live in Lawrence. Craig Wolf's mother is famous in Lawrence as the Audubon. Now then, what were the issues at that time with the Sierra Club? Can you tell us?
Well, that's it was the main issue right then was water quality as affected by the increasing number of CAFOs, these concentrated animal feeding operations, which I call animal factories for short. That was becoming more and more concerned all over the country, and so they took it up as a major issue. And I got a phone call from some people in Southwest Kansas who were real concerned about a huge influx of hog factories, and they asked me to come to a meeting in Wichita. And so that's before that, I didn't really know a cow from a pig. So, but that was 26 years ago now, and so.
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear you say that this issue goes so far back. I thought you would have said 93 it was rivers on fire or something, you know, industrial waste. But that's our topic today, concentrated animal feed operations, CAFOs is what I call them for short. And as we sit here, Craig, we can throw a rock to the stockyards area. So that was in the West Bottoms from 1871 and essentially closed down in 1991. So we have a history of animal selling in the Kansas City area. And tell us how it was before the CAFOs began. Farmers grew animals.
Right. They were mainly on pasture, or at least outdoors. In smaller numbers and in what I would call much healthier conditions. There were millions of more family farmers who depended on livestock pay their mortgage, essentially. That's what hogs were considered. They were called mortgage lifters. And so they were the ones who were essentially driven out of business when through a concerted effort starting in Washington, D.C., politicians and economists to essentially eliminate the small farmers because they were considered inefficient. And then they designed these CAFOs, which are based on a technology called intensive confinement. If you look at some of the early journal articles that the agriculture engineers wrote, they always were saying, we're going to change the whole industry with intensive confinement, without giving much thought to what happens when you confine thousands of animals of the same genetics into a tight space. Any biologist will tell you what's going to happen, and it does. You get much higher levels of disease, so what do? You give them antibiotics. And so now we have a crisis in our medical system with the loss of where they've generated antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And they all point to the livestock industry, for the most part, still using them.
Well, when I sat through a class you gave recently at Kansas University, a little seminar, I thought that it borrowed from the production plant. The specialization of labor is what this grows out of. So
that's
if I can
too.
Do one cow, I can do 1,000 cows, and that's all I'm going to do. And so it's it speaks about our modern mindset. And when I looked it up, CAFOs began with poultry in about 1950, and it took 1 million farms to house 57 million pigs, but by the year 2001, it took only 80,000 farms to house the same number. So there's a reduction in the number of farms.
Correct.
And that's one of the prices.
They're not really farms. They are literally animal factories. I mean, they are just buildings filled with these animals that they feed all the time.
Okay, now we can see those clearly right here around Kansas City. There's pork feedlots on the periphery of, on the east, northeast side of Kansas City, I
think. I don't think so. Oh, the north, up in Missouri, northwest Missouri, about 100 miles from here there are. Mm-hmm. But there's not any near the city particularly.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know how far a person would have to travel to see a poultry CAFO in Missouri again.
They're all in Missouri.
Right, in the southern part of Missouri.
A 100 miles again, mm-hmm. 150 miles.
Of course, we had an effort by Tyson to put a poultry CAFO in Tonganoxie, Kansas last year. And that was, the public really mounted an opposition to that.
Right. That was actually the slaughterhouse, but it's all interconnected with Tyson's, they're called an integrator, meaning they convince these farmers to grow 100,000 at a time, and then they send the trucks out to pick them up and bring them into the slaughterhouse. That was what they wanted to do. The slaughterhouse was at the city boundaries on the south side, was where they were going to put this horrendously large slaughterhouse, and then there would be something like 80 different sets of barns within 30 to 50 miles. So it was going to be this big integrated system that would have changed the character of that countryside completely.
So these are everywhere, and there are regulations on them, both state and federal, which regulate their operations. And let's go now to your recent lawsuit. The Sierra Club had a decision in their favor in December of 2019. So tell us about that case.
Well, we had a fairly large hog producer up in northwest Kansas who had a fire in his breeding facility, which was already a very big one, and it burned down about, I'd say, a third to a half of the facility, and all the animals died. And so he wanted to then not only rebuild, but to expand. And previously, he'd been just under the threshold that the legislature had set, where he had to be beyond 250 feet from the nearest water. And so he was just under that limit. So he wants to expand over that limit where the legislature said, you've got to be 500 feet away from the creek. It's called Prairie Dog Creek. So he couldn't really do that with his present location. So he came up with a scheme. Actually, it was, according to Tim Carpenter, the reporter for the Topeka Capital Journal, it was the attorney for the Kansas Livestock Association, came up with a workaround or a legal fiction for him that said that if he could just give away part of the site to his son and daughter-in-law and call it an LLC, or to form an LLC, limited liability corporation, that it would be legal under the regulations. That was their theory. Well, as soon as I found out about this plan, I realized that this would set a precedent in the state that would essentially eliminate the greater protections for surface water from these bigger swine confinements.
Now, that protection is you can only have facilities within 500 feet of each other.
Well, no, greater than 500 feet.
Okay, more than 500.
From the water body.
Okay, 500 feet from the water.
Right.
And the reason for that is there's manure in these hog houses,
right. And
they sluice those things every day, maybe more than one time a day, and just wash the manure out, and then it runs into a lagoon.
Right, a waste impoundment, right.
Right.
Theoretically, the impoundments are not supposed to leak, but they do. And theoretically, they're never supposed to be to collapse or to flood, but they do. And then they take that wastewater about every 6 months and pump it out on farmland. And, of course, it's not supposed to run off, but it does. So the legislature in foresight in 1998 said, well, if you want to have 10,000 pigs here, you're going to have to be further away from surface water. And so they were doing a workaround or a legal fiction, and we had really no choice. I mean, these are lawsuits are extremely laborious things to do. It's based on these kind of technical issues. And so I didn't want to get involved, but we had to, because they were going to set a precedent that would make a real difference in water quality in Kansas, which is already bad. 85% of the surface water in Kansas is what they call impaired, with one or another chemical like phosphorus or nitrogen or so on.
So this was the Sierra Club sued these pork
Correct.
Producers.
No, we actually sued Kansas Department of Health and Environment.
Oh, good.
Because they approved it.
Mm-hmm.
They could have said no, but they didn't. And they went along with this this workaround. And so we sued them because they're the regulatory body in this case. EPA has nothing to do with it.
And then it was in December of 2019, the judge said that Sierra Club is correct, that the permit should not have been issued.
Correct.
Right. So what's the status of that case? Where is it now?
Well, the judge did what they call a remand, or remanded the permits back to KDHE to be reworked in such a way as to bring them into compliance. However, the hog producer what they call intervened in the case, so they were represented, and they have already requested from the judge a stay of the ruling so that nothing happens until they appeal it. And KDHE, just in the last week, essentially agreed with the hog producer, and now they're going to appeal it. And, of course, we're going to say that they should be brought into compliance.
Because in the meantime, they have 10,000 hogs within 250 feet of surface water, this creek out in western Kansas.
Well, at 250, it's exactly 250 feet. It's very close.
Uh-huh.
So there's this potential to pollute all along. So,
well, that's a problem.
And 250 feet, that's not a lot. I mean, that's pretty limited.
No, it isn't. You know, not when you have, if you think about it,
water
it's actually
runs off
more than 10,000. When you've got more than 10,000 sows, in this case, which all weigh, a lot of them weigh 500 pounds, you're a hog, on average, will generate 3 to 4 times the amount of waste that a human does. So this thing puts out the amount of waste that a medium-sized city would.
Hmm. And how close, imagine, how close would you want that to be near your drinking water?
Well,
you probably wouldn't want to see it. You probably wouldn't want to, 250 right. feet isn't that far. Yeah,
a lot of the people in the area use wells, but some towns get their water from what they call the alluvial aquifer, which is the groundwater along these creeks, and it actually flows at a very low rate along with them. So it's kind of like a way of filtering it cheaply. You just get it out of the alluvial aquifer, and that's what this thing is sitting on top of.
Well, there must have been a reason for the reg when the Kansas Department of Health and Environment created the reg. They must have had a reason for saying these operations have to be more than 500 feet.
Well, that was the legislature that made the law, the statute. And
they're the enforcement agency.
And KDHE is just supposed to enforce and administer the permits. And in this case, they went along with the permittee and their attorney, which had been the, in this case, their, as far as this workaround was concerned, which was the Kansas Livestock Association.
Can I throw in a question here? I'm just curious, what did it take from, you know, the time that you all became aware of this issue and this court ruling in December? What were some steps in between there? If somebody were aware of something that was troublesome and seemed like it was against the law, what would it look like if you went to talk to the Sierra Club about that?
Because first I raised a protest at the very earliest stage, which was registration. And then they approved the tentatively approved the permit, so I had to write a comment. Then when they turned that down, the next step was to appeal it to a mid-level bureaucrat called the Director of Environment in KDHE, and they blew us off. And so then we had to go to the Secretary of KDHE with a final appeal, and he blew us off, but there was actually two sites, so double that, and it took, at the time, we had been working on that for over 2 years at the time the judge. Well, then when the secretary blew us off in two instances, both sites, we then appealed at the district court. And the official term for it is we've requested a review of administrative action. It was this was the court to review what the agency an agency action.
Mm-hmm. And so, this is you're working with lawyers from Sierra Club.
Oh yes, a wonderful lawyer, Bob I.
Bob probably, I.
He's a hero among environmental groups and others. He does other. He won a big award from the ACLU. He's a big libertarian. That's not the term.
Yeah,
civil libertarian.
Right.
He is also an expert in law associated with nuclear plants and nuclear waste. So he's had a tremendous career, and we were very fortunate to have him because going through that whole process requires legal assistance not to mess up the procedures.
That's just a few words to explain why we don't have Bob I present in the studio with us today. But sure, we checked with him, and he's just done tremendous work for the environment in this case and many others. So far, it looks as if the agency is on the side of the pork producer. Now, as a Kansas taxpayer, I am a little suspect of that. I think Kansas Department of Health and Environment is for the health and environment in Kansas. I believe they are. That's what I want to believe. So what would their possible excuse be? I don't think these pork producers are giving them pork chops or anything.
No. According to, the scheme or the workaround came from the livestock industry. And I think in the case of the livestock permits, the KDHE in my history with them tends to kind of lean in their direction because it's a very huge industry in Kansas. In some cases they don't, but I think that's an issue. There's real politics involved here.
I think that you're absolutely correct to say that it's very political, and also advocates just need to say over and over again, here are the harms involved in
right.
these types of operations, and that's the good work that you're doing. Now, when these CAFOs began in the United States, they were covered federally under the Clean Water Act, and then there are state regs that have been put in place. And the state reg that said 500 feet, do you know the year of that Kansas regulation?
1998.
And so we've come to a rule in 2008 adopted by the EPA that classed CAFOs into sizes and made regs on large CAFOs, medium
right.
CAFOs, small CAFOs. So all the government agencies are aware that these things are operating and that they have health and environment risks. And so then the government passes in 2013 the Right to Farm bills.
Well, that's a state law, but it's similar to laws in every state.
Right, yeah, I'm well aware it's a state law, but there are almost 48 states out of 50 have this law.
Yeah, I know where you're headed
right.
with that.
Well, where we're headed, we're going to take a little break here, and when we come back, I want to touch on the Right to Farm bills and what we have learned from that type of legislation, and then I want to talk about the issues of CAFOs, of concentrated animal feed operations, in case any of our listeners are not yet aware that meat product that you buy stands the chance of having contamination and not being quality food for people, for food places, for the operation where they were produced. So we'll be right back.
KKFI is hosting a community ascertainment forum on Thursday, January 23rd at the station, 39th and Main, Kansas City, Missouri's second floor. Community leaders will make short presentations about the activities of their organizations. Doors open at 5:15 and the program starts at 6 p.m. Please join us on January 23rd for the Community Ascertainment Forum.
Most times, KKFI moves against the stream, but just saying play KKFI to your smart speaker will bring our stream to you.
Did you know that you can donate your unwanted car, boat, truck, or motorcycle to KKFI Radio and get a tax deduction for your donation? Find out more by calling KKFI at 816-931-3122. This is Pat Fisher from Kansas City, a volunteer for 90.1 FM KKFI, our community radio station.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In many small rural settlements in South Africa, residents live in metal shacks with no connections to the regional electricity grid. But now, in one of these settlements, lights are shining.
Each shack operates on a solar panel and a battery.
Lilia Abram is the president of Peer Consultants, an environmental engineering consulting firm, and its sister company, Peer Africa. For decades, she's worked to bring energy-efficient housing to post-apartheid South Africa. Abram says that as part of a project in Kites Municipality in Northern Cape Province, Pure Africa has helped equip more than 500 homes with independent electrical systems.
The solar panel on the roof and the battery is enough to operate inside lights, outdoor lights, a refrigerator, color TV, sewing machine.
Now children can read and study in the evenings by lamplight, and outdoor areas are well lit, which helps to improve safety. So Abram says that the benefits of renewable energy technologies go far beyond the climate.
It's about using science and technology to transform the lives of people.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
This is Terry Wilkie. You're listening to Eco Radio KC, and Dave Freeling and I are welcoming to have Craig Voland of the Kansas Sierra Club, the Agriculture Committee Chair. And when we left off, Craig, we were talking about the 2013 Right to Farm Bill. In 2013, it was passed in Kansas. But I did my research, and I see the Right to Farm bills, there are bills in many, many states, were developed in the 1970s as a response to suburban encroachment on agricultural land. So the suburbs were going into the farms, and the Right to Farm bills were passed to protect the farmland from roads and baseball fields and bright lights and the type of things that suburbia brings to farmland. And then in 2014, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, financially backed Missouri's Right to Farm Amendment, Amendment 1, fueling further controversy that the Right to Farm laws are being enacted to assist corporate agriculture.
Correct.
So as we sit here today, I don't know how many of our listeners got to see that Right to Harm film that showed recently in Kansas City. The Right to Farm bill protects the corporations from devaluing other farmers' agricultural land. So let's pretend I have a farm. I have 250 acres, and a large pork producer moves in next to me, and then they take the contaminated wastewater, it's contaminated with pork feces, and they begin to spray it on fields of my neighbors on the other two sides.
Right.
And so now I get to live in a very bad spot where I have the actual feed operation in front of me, and then on two sides I have people spraying feces on their crops. On their crops as water and as fertilizer. Is that what's going on?
Right. This material also has antibiotic-resistant bacteria in it. Which is it's dangerous material.
Well, it goes without saying that feces has E. coli in it.
True.
And I'm glad that you raised that, because when I think about contamination of our food products, I always remember the Rocky Ford cantaloupe case. I was so surprised at that. People were dying from eating cantaloupe just a few years ago. And so then the news reports that it's Listeria, and I knew that was a bacteria. And I didn't understand how you could put it on a cantaloupe and have it get to the store where a person could buy it and get it in their own system, because cantaloupes have a hard rind. And as I continued to read, that came from the water that the cantaloupes were irrigated with. And so that was contaminated water that was used to water cantaloupes that then go to the store, and then a person buys it and eats a cantaloupe and gets a bad bacterial infection that hospitalized many, many people in the United States. We see this going on in more recent history with romaine lettuce.
Right.
And it's the same bad bacteria.
Well, the right to farm, the more recent versions of the right to farm law, not only in Missouri and Kansas, but elsewhere, to a substantial extent, a result of successful lawsuits by neighbors of these hog factories, who obviously didn't want these things polluting their environment. So they sued, and in many cases won these large judgments, particularly in Missouri. So the response is for the legislatures that were backing Big Ag to pass these laws that said that as long as the farmer was using good agricultural practices, meaning that they were meeting the regulations, that you could not sue them for damages. So, of course, the regulations are all very weak, as I've started to explain. And there's obvious damage going on. There's been study after study showing that property values next to these big hog factories in particular drop. This is no secret. So what this means is that the legislature is basically deciding the rights of the neighbors, what those rights are, instead of a jury. You know, in our system, I thought, until recently, that if you had a harm on you, that you could go to court and get a judgment in your favor. But essentially, they've taken that away from. It's just about rural neighbors. It's not hurting city people in Kansas City. It's hurting people that want to live in the countryside and have all the advantages of the big spaces, and they come in and essentially take away the right to protect themselves. That's why it's called the right to harm in that documentary.
Yeah, it's a play on the term right to farm. So a person buys a farm. Let's say they buy 250 acres at $1,000 an acre, $250,000. This is their family farm. And then CAFO moves in next door, brings its stench and dirt and traffic, and then the value of the 250 acres would be much less than $1,000 an acre, because who's going to buy a place that's situated right next door to a concentrated animal feed operation? And so the money that is invested in the farm cuts drastically.
An economist would call that an external cost, meaning that the hog producer, in order to have the privilege of spraying their waste on the crops, doesn't have to pay the cost to the neighbors. The neighbors have to pay a cost that should be incorporated into the cost of the pork, but isn't. That's an external cost, which any economist will tell you. Any form of pollution is an external cost that is not incorporated into the cost of the product.
Now, the environmental impact of CAFOs is water pollution and air pollution. So we've talked about the water is polluted by feces, And the air is polluted by stench.
Primarily odor, but odor, when it comes to CAFOs, odor is really certain gases on particles that blow out of these barns.
And like methane. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, but the gases are adsorbed onto these particles. If you can smell something like, if you can smell manure that... in many instances, you're actually getting the particles with it on it. Now, in some cases, just gases come off these waste impoundments or lagoons. So in that case, it would be gases. There's over 200 gases, chemical gases, that stink at the parts per billion level. That's how sensitive we are to some of the gases coming off of these lagoons. And I'm not talking about ammonia. Quantity-wise, that's the largest one that comes off. Then there's methane, and there's hydrogen sulfide, which can be deadly in a confined space. But there's also like 200 different gases that comprise odor.
The Kansas Department of Health and Environment has inspectors that go to these operations, and they check levels of pollution in the lagoons. They check to see the status of the lagoons, and they come dressed in space outfits, don't they? They have helmets on and respirators.
They bring respirators with them. They don't wear a suit necessarily, but they almost never go inside the buildings because the air is so dangerous. But they have respirators with them in case they are called upon to go inside, but they almost never do. The only thing they look at is whether the ponds are about to overflow or if there's a spill of manure on the ground somewhere. That's essentially, they do not regulate the air. The air from CAFOs is essentially not regulated under the Clean Air Act.
I'm sorry to hear that. Another issue are the public health concerns. So as we're talking about the contamination of the water is contaminated with bacteria and virus, and then the animals themselves have disease and death.
Right.
In a concentrated animal feed operation, there's animals that die there, and then they
regularly
begin to decay.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And
well, they don't allow them to decay inside. They every day they go in and pick up all the deads, as they call them, their mortalities, and then they take them over to a big bin, and then that's carted off regularly every 2 days or so to a rendering plant where they're rendered down and then in some cases put back into the feed. Other cases it might be in animal food or pet food. So that's what happens to all the deads. But it's typical that there's a even in good conditions where there's no viral outbreak, they could easily lose 10% of their animals during this process. When there's a viral outbreak, it can be almost the entire barn of animals will die, or in the 20s and 30%. So there are lots of disease in these things, and that's why in order to enter them, the employees have to wash their – they have to take a shower. They have to wash their boots. This is all a function. This is all an artifact of intensive confinement. And we've known this for a long time. When you cram all these particular species of animals of the same genetics in the same place, you're going to get spread of disease. And so they spend enormous amounts of money trying to prevent this basic fact. And it's a fundamentally flawed technology, fundamentally flawed. And the other thing is, if you concentrate all these animals in one place, you're concentrating all their waste in one place. So you get these vast concentrations of waste that is very poorly treated, if at all.
Have you heard about the there's a guy named Bill Marler, is a lawyer. Just yesterday, he is working on trying to outlaw different types of salmonella, because right now there's only certain strains that are tested for, and those aren't the strains that are most commonly infecting people these days.
Oh, really? I didn't know.
Because a lot
of
them have become resistant, and there's new strains right. popping up. And so, yeah, just he was the guy who fought and won against Jack in the Box in a big food poisoning.
Oh, that big case. That's event. Been 20 years ago.
Yeah, right? But it was a turning point about E. coli.
Oh, yes.
Helped pass some laws about E. coli. So now he's working on salmonella, and the food industry is pretty scared of that, or at least the meat packing and chicken in particular is pretty concerned about this issue. So that's something that's on the radar, and we should do what we can to keep abreast of that and support right. him if we're into it. You know, I think it's going to be a big issue.
I think I would not claim that even of what I call free range animal products that are done right on pasture, you should even be careful with them. But if you're go to an ordinary grocery store and pick up a package of meat, you can the odds are significant that there will be not only bacteria on that meat, but anaerobic resistant bacteria. So you have to be extremely careful handling meat in your house. In fact, there was a 60 Minutes piece on this recently that did a really good job of talking about that.
So we have problems to the people's health, public health concerns, and then we have problems with the animal health and welfare concerns. Now, Craig, this is where I think your message, it breaks your heart to see animals right. being confined in these very small spaces for mm-hmm. their the duration of their life, and mm-hmm. which is several months to maybe a year. And they don't really get to move around. They don't get any kind of buildup of their body muscle.
No.
They have to wrestle with other animals of their kind for food.
Yeah, they dock the tails of pigs because they'll bite each other because for space.
And chickens are carnivores,
yeah,
too. Yeah,
they de-beak mm-hmm. the chicks.
Cannibals, right.
Uh-huh. Because they'll pick each other for lack of space. That's on the layer facilities where they're all in these tiny cages. And it's all, again, it's intensive confinement, this idea that the human species has the right to treat these animals that way. When, in fact, we've actually done this to ourselves. There's the concentration camps. The Nazi concentration camps was the same principle. The ships bringing slaves over from Africa they were all crammed into the hold of these ships. Many of them died. That's intensive confinement. So why do we have a food system that's based on that ridiculous idea?
So we've been talking about CAFOs and how they cost more than they make, the profits from them and the low, in quotes, low price at the grocery store. It might be more expensive than you think. Their effect on negative effect on property values, the increased pollution, the animal cruelty. So, Craig, we have only 5 minutes, and let's go out and tell our listeners where they can obtain quality product. So right. that where do we obtain, short of raising a pig, good pork product in the modern world?
Right. Well, this would apply to chickens, too. I will say cattle feedlots, in my opinion, aren't as bad because they're external in many cases. There's a problem with those, too. But it's not as bad as the ones that are totally confined, chickens and pork. So you can go to the Kansas City Food Circle .org website and download their directory of farmers who produce animal products the right way.
Okay, so I'm going to say that loud and clear. KCFoodCircle.org.
Right.
And that gives a source in the greater Kansas City area for places that produce meat product that is a smaller operation.
Much
and a
smaller.
Cleaner operation.
Right. They're outdoors they cannot use antibiotics, and they don't need them. It's been shown over and over again that if you're raising animals out where they can express their normal behaviors and they're healthy and not stressed, that they don't need antibiotics. But I will say this, in order to make that work, to essentially go back to pastured and free-range animal products, we all have to eat less meat. The whole reason why CAFOs exist is because after World War II, the animal associations got together with USDA and promoted the eating of meat. And they made meat this in every meal. That wasn't true before World War II. Now meat is at the slabs of meat are at the center of every plate. Mm. That is no accident. That was propaganda over decades after World War II. So you got everybody eating all this meat. They think even a veggie burger has to be in the form of a burger. You don't need to make a burger to eat vegetables. So it was all in our minds that we just have to have meat at every meal. So in order to get rid of these CAFOs, we need to reduce, not eliminate necessarily, unless you want to, we need to reduce this wholesale consumption of meat because that's what supports these things.
And there are many, many good vegetables and grains, beans that can be eaten that have protein in them. If a person doesn't mind having milk and cheese, although milk is produced in concentrated animal feed operations too. Mm-hmm. So it's good to go to kcfoodcircle.org and find a local producer. Or someone, a local dairy.
Yeah, I don't want to tell anybody what to eat. That's a distinctly personal decision. My own, my partner and I, we eat just modest amounts of meat, and I know where it all came from. I know the names of the farmers that it came from. So that's what I would advocate is if you want to eat meat, then just know your farmer.
And I'll tell you, too, I have been kicking around ways to go to the tooth. Meat has something to the tooth. That's the way the chefs say it.
Oh.
And so root vegetables will do that, too. It's kind of when you bite it, you feel like, okay, I have a bite of something
substance,
in my mouth. Yeah, substance. Mm-hmm. And it sticks with you. And so those are good products. And not mashed now, but slice them and oven roast them and put some seasoning on that, and that's a very good way to eat. So now I think the Food Circle has a dinner event, don't they?
No, it's an expo. There's a transition going on right now with the Kansas City Food Circle. The parts of it are transitioning to be taken over by other local food groups in the coming year. So there's been a tentative date set for the Farmers Expo this year of April 4th, but you need to watch on Facebook and other groups you're connected to get confirmation on that.
Well, I want you to keep listening to Eco Radio KC and look at our Facebook page because we'll keep you posted on that annual event. And, Craig, thank you so much for being on Eco Radio KC. Yeah. This was a great interview, and I appreciate you very, very much.
Well, I appreciate KKFI.
Here's the calendar of events for the week of January 20th, 2020. Tuesday, January 21st, 6:30 p.m., is an Extinction Rebellion KC chapter meeting at the St. Mark Hope and Peace Lutheran, 38th and Troost, KCMO. Meeting entrance is on Mannheim side of the church. New members are welcome. Thursday, January 23rd, 10 to 11:30 a.m., plant propagation workshop at the Sunflower Room of the Wyandotte County Extension Office, 1208 North 79th Street, Kansas City, Kansas. This class will teach the various methods to propagate plants. Presenter is Lynn Loffery, Wyandotte County, Kansas Extension Horticulture Agent, sponsored by the Wyandotte County Extension Master Gardeners. Registration is not required. Please call 913-299-9300 if you need further information. Thousands of migrating bald eagles can be seen during the winter months at Missouri Department of Conservation Eagle Days events. Clarksville, Saturday, January 25th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. and Sunday, January 26th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Lock and Dam 24 and Appleshed Theater in Clarksville. Call 660-785-2424 for more information. And Stella, Saturday, January 25th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Stella Veterans Memorial Park, 774 Ozark Street. Call 417-629-3423 for more information. Saturday, January 25th, Planting a Prairie, 9 a.m. at Shawnee Mission Park, 7900 Renner Road, Overland Park, Kansas. Landowners are invited to attend a free workshop to learn how to plant native prairie, learn about site preparation, how to get your planting started, receive maintenance tips, and find out about possible funding. Sunrise Movement, Lawrence, Kansas. January open meeting will be Sunday, January 26th from 2:30 p.m. at Lawrence Public Library, 707 Vermont, Meeting Room A. See on Facebook. Earth Care Forum on Restoring Connections in the Tallgrass Prairie will be Sunday, January 26, 9:40 to 10:45 a.m. at the First Presbyterian Church, Fireside Room, 2415 Clinton Parkway, Lawrence. For more info, contact tjholcomb@gmail.com. Please listen to Eco Radio KC next week. We will share our recording of Harvard professor James Levitt's presentation on large landscape conservation in the modern age. These items and more can be viewed at the Eco Radio KC Facebook page. Stay tuned now for Fiesta Musicale.
Is the Panama Canal running out of water? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The Panama Canal connects the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, and more than 12,000 cargo and passenger ships travel through it every year. But currently, there's not enough water to handle all that traffic.
One might think that the water in the canal is from the oceans it connects. However, it actually requires millions of gallons of fresh water to operate.
The canal's administration released an analysis showing that 2019 was the fifth driest year in 70 for the area, with rainfall 20% below the historic average. The current dry season is just beginning, which could last as late as July.
Last year, water depths in the canal reached such low levels that limits had to be imposed on the amount of cargo that ships could carry. Any weight above the limit had to be offloaded and moved overland.
The canal also supplies fresh water to Panama City, home to about half of the country's population of 4 million. And as the Associated Press reports, each ship's passage involves millions of gallons of fresh water, much of which is released into the oceans.
A $5 billion expansion of the canal in 2016 significantly increased its ability to handle bigger ships, but that also requires much more water.
To fund solutions to the problem, ships passing through the canal will have to pay higher fees, and the number of slots has been reduced from 32 to 27 per day.
Despite opposition from many environmentalists, the Senate last week passed the new trade deal among the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, known as the USMCA, a revised version of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA.
10 Democratic senators opposed the legislation, echoing the concerns of 9 major environmental groups, including the Sierra Club and the Sunrise Movement.
The groups criticized the bill for not addressing climate change and for failing to adequately tackle toxic pollution. They say the agreement includes weak environmental standards and has an even weaker enforcement mechanism than the deal it replaces.
Critics also say USMCA supports fossil fuels and allows oil and gas corporations to challenge climate and environmental protections.
The New Republic reports that all of the tar sands oil that flows to the U.S. from Canada through the Keystone XL pipeline will be exempt from tariffs under the new agreement.
At the end of last week, heavy rains and thunderstorms hit parts of Australia's east coast.
The rains doused some of the region's fires, but also brought the threat of flooding to some areas. The fires have been burning since September, destroying thousands of homes, killing 28 people, and about a billion animals.
The BBC reports that about 75 fires were still burning in New South Wales on Saturday, down from over 100 a few days ago.
But there's some good news. A secret operation of special firefighters saved the world's last stand of wallaby pines from the bushfires.
The pines are a prehistoric species known as dinosaur trees, which grow up to 130 feet high and are believed to have existed since the Jurassic period, 200 million years ago, predating many dinosaurs.
Agence France-Presse reports that fewer than 200 of the trees exist in the wild, hidden in a gorge hit by one of the biggest bushfires.
As fire came close, air tankers dropped fire retardant in a ring around the trees, while firefighters were lowered into the gorge to set up an irrigation system to provide moisture for the pines.
The operation was described as an unprecedented environmental protection mission that saved the ancient species.
It's been assumed that as drought increases in parts of the world, so will conflict. That assumption has been supported by research that shows regional wars, such as those in Syria, Yemen, and Sudan, will be exacerbated by climate change.
But a new study shows that drought may not always lead to conflict because, as the news site Earther describes, going to war over dry land may simply not be worth it.
During particularly dry years, it's been more valuable for nations to recruit agricultural workers as soldiers to acquire more territory rather than farm.
But if drought becomes normal, it doesn't make much sense to obtain new land because it might not be very productive anyway.
However, Elizabeth Chalecki of the University of Nebraska said that dry years or wet years, good harvests or bad, climate change is causing conditions to become more variable, and we might see more conflict just because of less predictability year to year.
The study doesn't show that we'll see less war in a warming world. Other variables not analyzed, such as forced migration due to a lack of water, could increase the likelihood of war in some places. And finally this week, when we do laundry, research shows that with each load, we're sending hundreds of thousands of microfibers down the drain, which ultimately flow into oceans and harm sea life. But according to new research, you can reduce your impact and make your clothes last longer.
Scientists from the University of Leeds have found that shorter, cooler wash cycles not only keep clothes looking good, but release fewer microfibers into wastewater.
In fact, the researchers found that cold, short washes reduce the amount of fibers released by over half, and that the amount of dye going down the drain was cut by nearly three quarters.
And washing clothes in cooler water reduces its carbon footprint by using about two-thirds less energy.
The study was conducted with a team from Procter & Gamble, who said clothes get just as clean because of advances in detergents that rely on sustainable ingredients such as enzymes.
Bottom line, short cold washes will slow down the aging of clothes, so you're going to save money replacing garments and on your energy bill, all while reducing the impact on ocean environments.
That's it for this week in Water. We'll see you next time.
Eco Radio is produced by a team of collaborators, including yours truly, Craig Lubo, Teresa Wilkie, Dave Bennett, and Brent Ragsdale. Thanks to Ryan Porky for our theme music. I'm Richard Mabian, reminding you to give your feedback by contacting us at ecoradio@gmail.com or reaching out to Eco Radio KC, our Facebook page.